Welcome back to the It's a Classic podcast. I'm your host, Zion Lashua, and today I am once again joined by my good friend, Nicholas Kahn. Nick, say hi.
Hello, everybody.
And how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you, Zion?
I'm good. I'm excited about this story and to get back into like recording the podcast because it has like been a while because I kind of worked through the backlog a bit. So I haven't like recorded an episode for a while. So yeah, I'm excited to get back and talk about it. And this story is like pretty weird and kind of obscure. So I'm excited to like get the story out there and I hope that you like it too. Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm filled with suspense at the possibility.
Okay. I'm so glad. So the so the first thing, right? This is a bit of a long story. I assume today we're probably only gonna like get through like the first like chunk of it. And in the future I'll have you back on to go through the middle and then the conclusion because it's like really long.
An epic. This
yeah.
Sounds cool.
Well, I'd be hesitant to call it an epic. I think you'll get it once we get into the meat of the story. So it's known by a couple different names, one of which is the Metamorphosis, but it's like more commonly known as the Golden Ass. That's the first kind of bit. Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming to get into this story that we have not told yet.
I am so excited for this story. Well, I wonder what the story could be.
I definitely did not forget
to do. I hope there's donkeys in it.
I did not forget to do the intro, and I'm not doing it after the fact. I hope you enjoy the story because the story of the Golden Ass, it's a classic. It was written by a guy named Apuleius, and he lived around like 124 AD to 170 AD. He lived in Numidia. Yeah, Numidia, which is a Roman like colony on the coast of North Africa.
Okay.
And
okay. Whereabouts would it be kind of today? Would it be kind of close to Egypt side of things or kind of where in North Africa are we thinking? Near Carthage?
A bit more west. Yeah, kind of near Carthage, a bit more west than Egypt.
Okay.
And there's not like a ton that's talked about the guy himself, but he was once accused of like witchcraft and he had to defend himself. Yeah.
And did he do so successfully?
Yes, he did. He was not. And that we actually, and I might go into that at some point in another episode as well, that like text that he used to defend himself from the accusations is like did survive. So we have that as well. And he wrote that first. And then later he wrote this story. And I think we'll just get right into it because it is, like I said, it's long and it's also full of a lot of it's a bit like Frankenstein in that way where it has like a billion frame narratives. Like you'll get like a frame narrative and then you'll go within that narrative to get another narrative. And so it's a bit messy, and so I'll try my best to like explain it as well as I can.
That's fine. And I feel like I don't know that would be unique for the period, but that kind of complexity would be an interesting little feature compared to, because I know that a lot of like the poetry and stuff, I don't know exactly what period, but they would kind of be framed from either like a divine perspective, right? Or something like with the muses.
Yeah, exactly. So and this is actually one of the few kind of complete surviving Latin novels that like has survived till this day. So it's like really, it gives us not only a perspective into the history, but also into like the weird kind of what the perspectives of people would have been in terms of literature, which I think is like a totally unique perspective. I don't know. It's pretty interesting.
Absolutely.
So we'll jump right into book one. It's like divided. And the first thing that is like an intro, kind of like you were talking about with like an invocation of the muses, except this one is like a direct like address to the reader, basically saying he does a big summary, right? Basically explaining the whole story, which I skipped when I first read it because I didn't want to know like spoilers.
It's the tagline. It's the movie tagline on the this time it's personal for Jaws. You can't skip over that.
No, I mean, it was more like, here's exactly what happens in six sentences. And I'm like, I don't want a synopsis of the book before I read it. Which was pretty
maybe
common.
That's how we sold copies. It's the version of the description on the back.
Oh, yeah.
Did it also have like a New York Times bestseller kind of inscription? Rome, no, was like Rome best, Times bestseller.
Yeah, best-selling author out of Numidia. So at the end of that little intro, he says, like, give me your ear, reader, for I am sure that you will enjoy yourself. So he's very confident that his readers are going to, like what he's written, which I like, you know, that level of confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, confidence is good. Hopefully it's merited. I'm going to judge harshly.
Good. I would have it no other way. The first thing is that we meet the narrator, whose name is Lucius, and he is on his way to Thessaly. And he's vague about why. He says, like, he's going on particular business, but, like, it's not necessarily important. And he has ridden his, like, pure white horse over miles of passes, valleys, pastures, and sticky plowlands, is how he refers to it.
Sticky plow? Okay.
Yeah. And his horse was getting tired, so he dismounted, and he led the horse on slowly, and it ate grass as they walked. And soon, Lucius hears two men speaking to each other, and they're laughing. And then there's one, like, phrase that he hears in particular, which was, that was the most absurd thing that you have ever told me. Which is, like, pretty interesting.
Oh, intriguing. Yeah, I'd want to know what that could be.
So, you know, Lucius has the same mindset. He barges in saying, he's like, well, you know, I'm not nosy. I just like to know things. So what was that story you were just talking about?
Yeah. And, not nosy with an N, but nosy with a K-N-O-W.
Yeah, I like to nosy things. He also says that the second man is stupid for not believing his friend's story before he's even, like, heard it. He's just like, how dare you not believe your friend? so then Lucius, he just, like, barges in on this conversation and then just starts talking. He describes a crazy thing that he saw. He's like, well, I've seen crazy things. So the craziest thing that I saw was a man that was sword swallowing, and he used a lance to sword swallow. And then another beautiful man climbed up and used the lance to pole dance as it was still in the other man's mouth, which sounds like insane.
That would be crazy. I would definitely tip well at the end of that performance, because that would be horrifically dangerous. Why don't we do that nowadays? There are just not shows
instead of people, like, playing, like, the violin on, like, a street corner, they're just, like, sword swallowing and pole dancing all in one.
Absolutely. I mean, it'd be dangerous on a busy street, but I mean, that just adds to the danger a little bit. Oh my god.
So basically Lucius basically says that, like, if I've seen that, then your story can't possibly be anywhere near that crazy as my, like, sword swallowing stripper pole story. The man then introduces himself as Aristomenes. Yes, Aristomenes, and then begins his tale. So this is what I was talking about. Like, we're less than, like, 8 paragraphs in or something, and we're already, like, in another story within the story. And that's just, like,
yeah,
it's going to be a lot of that. So
he's collecting stories.
Aristomenes begins by saying he swears that this is 100% true. And he explains that he is a cheese seller and that he travels to find rare cheeses and buys it wholesale and then sells for a profit in other markets.
That is the dream job. It never even occurred to me that that would be, like, an excellent job to have in that time and place.
Yeah.
Like, I do not think that there would be a place for me at all, except maybe as a cheese person. I love the cheese section of, like, a grocery store with, like, oh, like, the brie and, like, mm-hmm. the humble fog.
If you were transported back to Roman times, you'd be like, I have nothing to offer unless I could buy and sell cheese.
Yes, that's it. That is the only thing that I would do. I think that's the only sustainable job that I could pick up for a little. Like, oh yes, look at this wheel. Look at this fine-ass wheel.
Yeah, he just goes to places, buys a big wheel of cheese, and then goes somewhere else and sells it by the slice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then he went to Hypatia, he went to Hypatia, which is an area, and he heard that there is a particularly special cheese for sale there. Unfortunately, he missed out because some dude named Lupus bought it before he got there. So he's disappointed and he heads to the public baths.
Competitive industry. It's tough.
Yeah, I guess so. This is reminding me of this is, like, a very niche topic, but right now in the Pokemon card collecting community, like, all Pokemon cards are being bought up. Like scalpers are buying them and then trying to resell them for, like, outrageous profit. So you go to, like, a Target and the Pokemon card section will be absolutely empty because people are buying.
Well, I've been hearing about it. It's a pretty new trend too.
Yeah.
Is it like the pandemic? There's, like, the card opening videos and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. And then a lot of people made card opening videos, especially of, like, the like vintage cards. And the vintage cards are worth a lot, but now people are even expanding that to kind of the modern cards and are just, like, buying them all up. So if you're just, like, a casual family trying to get, like, a Pokemon card pack for your child, you go and there's none left for you.
Well, just continuing the comparison then, what this Lupin has done is he has bought the cheese, this very rare cheese, in order to set up a table on a street corner and cut it open and ooh and ah at it and have crowds, not to give out any flavors or anything. Just look at the color, look at the hue of this.
Look at this
cheese.
Slice, ooh.
Smell it, but not too close. Not too close at all.
I'm going to get this slice of cheese graded by PSA, and it's going to come back in a PSA 10.
Perfectly symmetrical circles in this Swiss cheese, yeah.
So yeah, that's essentially what just happened. And so,
my goodness.
Aristomenes is one of these people who gets there too late, and he's sad, so he goes to the public baths. And on his way, he sees an old friend of his, Socrates, not the famous one.
Okay, I was about to ask. Yeah. Damn, no.
This is not the right era. I wish it was that
I thought
one.
It was a celebrity cameo of just,
just being like, and then I passed my buddy Socrates. Yeah, you know the one.
Ever heard of him?
Just like casual name drop. No, it's just some other dude. And he sees his old friend Socrates lying filthy on the floor. So very much like in the vibe of the actual famous Socrates, but not that one. And so then Aristomenes approaches him and he says that, he's like, what are you doing? Everyone at home thinks you're dead. Your wife is back there and your kids are with some new guardians. And there was even a funeral. Like, what's up, dude? Like, why are you here and filthy and everyone thinks you're dead?
Yeah.
And then Socrates just moans and complains to Aristomenes. And then Aristomenes takes him and like takes him to the baths and like cleans him up and stuff. And eventually Aristomenes is like, okay, now tell me your story. So now we're going another layer deep. We're going into Socrates' story within Aristomenes' story within Lucius' story within Apuleius' story.
Oh my God, it's storyception. It's continued.
I think this is as deep as we go, but we'll see. I don't remember.
There's not a bottom layer where just crumbling cities everywhere and I'll run into somebody's dead wife who will try to kill me.
I don't remember Inception well enough to get your deep cut references.
Come on, you make anime references all the time and you can't give me a Christopher Nolan movie? Come on.
Well, I thought the inner sanctum was like the weird snowy area where they were like assaulting a snow fort or something.
We don't have time for a story within a story within your right. stories, but that was only the third layer deep zone.
Oh no. So Socrates' story is that he had traveled to Macedonia and on his way home, he was ambushed by bandits. They took everything from him. And Socrates stumbled to a nearby inn run by a woman named Moreau. Now, Moreau felt sorry for this, like, man down on his luck. And then they sleep together. Like, that's the extension. Like, he's like, oh, I'm so sorry. That, you know, they go at it. So Aristomenes then interjects and says, like, well, then you deserve the state you're in. You abandon your family to sleep with some hag running an inn. Very mean to Moreau. I don't know if she was a hag or not. And then...
Yeah, I don't know that she deserves... Especially, I don't know. This guy hasn't had a bath in a little bit and stuff like that.
So Socrates is like, shh, 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 shh. Moreau might hear you, for she is a witch.
Okay.
And then he goes off and explains examples of her, like, witchiness. So one of her past lovers was unfaithful, and she turned him into a beaver. Apparently, this was a misconception about beavers, which I looked up later because I was like, I don't think this is true. Apparently, it was believed at the time that beavers would chew off their own balls to escape predators.
Oh, okay.
Like how a lizard would, like, pop off its tail, right? A beaver would, like, chop off its own testicles with its, like, teeth, then throw them at the predator and run.
Okay, so it's not even that their testicles are, like, have been seized by this other creature. Have been,
no,
like,
no, no.
They would crushed under a rock. No. It's just, that's would, their ammo.
That was their ammo, yeah.
Oh, great, good.
And I was like, there's no way that's true. So I looked it up and it's not true. It was just, like, a thing that people thought about beavers.
There must have been an inciting incident, though. There must have been a beaver without balls, and the guy was just
and they
like,
were like, oh.
There's only one possible reason.
Everybody knows this about beavers.
Yeah.
Another instance of her, like, using magic was there was a competing innkeeper, and she turned him into a frog so that she would have less competition. But then he still runs an inn. Like, he still ran the inn as a frog. So I feel like that would make me want to go to that inn way more than the witch inn.
I mean, I agree. The novelty of that would be like a little frog carrying my bags up to my room and stuff.
You'd make the frog carry your bags?
I mean, if he's there, it's the novelty of the inn. Come on.
Right. No, yeah,
I,
you're right.
I would tip well some flies. I'd cast dance over that. So getting the keys.
She also, a lawyer who took a case against her, she turned him into a ram, who now also still does cases as a ram. A wife.
Can they still speak English? Or not? It wouldn't be English. Latin. Can they still speak in human tongue?
Probably. I don't know. I think it'd be kind of hard to argue cases as a ram if you couldn't speak.
Whatever works for you. Maybe they just stamp really hard.
Yeah, and everyone's man.
It's a nuzzling in. It's actually just a physical threat. Not a very good lawyer, but willing to do anything to win the case.
And what does the opposition say? He makes a good case.
The opposition says, I have horns, so yeah. Try me.
A wife of one of her lovers, she cursed her to be forever pregnant. And so everyone started to hate her, Moreau. And so they threatened to stone her. And she negotiated one final day to get her affairs in order. She was like, oh, you know, like, I need to get some stuff done before you stone me to death. And they were like, okay, fine. And then
there is no way I would do that because she would just turn everyone into some kind of an animal.
She then used magic to trap everyone in their homes. Like, she sealed all their doors until they swore to never harm her. Like, weeks later after they were, like, starving, they were like, okay, we won't hurt you. So, yeah, basically what you said exactly is what happened.
Yeah, no, they should have known better. Fools, absolutely.
And I think
she's impressive, though.
Yeah, right? I think this is very much reminiscent of the story of Medea, which I haven't gone into the podcast yet, but will definitely come up. Because Medea does something very similar, like the king of... is she in Athens at that point? No, she flees to Athens after. I forget where she is at that point. Corinth, maybe? Anyway, the king's like, oh, you have to leave. And she's like, one more day, please. And then he's like, oh, okay. And then that's when she, like, kills everybody. Well, she kills, like, two people. It's not that big of a deal. Then
she kills enough people to figure things out.
Yeah. So now that's, like, Socrates' story. So it's not actually that much of a story within a story with a story. It's a pretty short story. So then
But that's it. He just is like, I can't leave because she's a witch, and I mean, it's a valid excuse. It makes sense. I would not try to leave if I was also dating a witch. I don't.
He's like, I'm scared.
Yeah.
So we then cut back to Aristomenes, and he's like, okay, man, that story stressed me out. Let's go drink wine and then go sleep at a different inn. Like, let's go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. The two, Socrates and Aristomenes, like, they go drink wine and they, like, book a room for the night and they fall asleep. Around midnight, the door flew off its hinges, and Aristomenes was, like, jolted awake. The assailants barged in, flipped over his bed, and pinned him underneath it. So Aristomenes is now, like, crushed under his bed, like, looking on as, like, at these people. In his terror, Aristomenes still could not help but laugh at the idea of himself as a tortoise. Like, he was like, I'm terrified, but also, like, I'm a tortoise. Isn't that funny?
Because of the bed on his back, the
yeah,
shell.
Because of the bed on his back.
Oh my god! Hey, whatever comforts you in situations of crisis.
What'd you say?
Whatever comforts you in situations of crisis to get through it.
Yeah, I guess right. So he looked up to see two elderly women standing aside Socrates, who was still asleep somehow. One held a sponge, and the other held a sword. And then, like, he puts together, it's like, oh my god, this must be Moreau. And so then one of them speaks up and, like, says to... So basically, yeah, Moreau says to her sister, who's the other woman, Panthea...
Which one has the sponge? Might not be important. It's not important at all.
I don't remember which one has the sponge. I'm looking up, like, I don't... So Moreau...
It's so important. I'm sorry.
I'm going to say that... Oh, Moreau had the sword. Panthea had the sponge.
Moreau had the sword. Okay, I don't know that I'm judging which one to fear more, but for some reason, someone holding a sponge instead of a sword in this situation
is, like, very
more
sinister.
Red flags to me. Yeah,
I think I think you might be right about that, Nick.
Okay.
So Moreau says to her sister Panthea that this is the man they're looking for. He is her love, and he has fled from her. So Panthea then looks at Aristomenes and asks Moreau what they should do with, like, despair. Like, what do we do with this guy? And then they start debating. They're like, should we castrate him? Should we tear him limb from limb? But then Moreau is like, okay, hold on. You're getting a little ahead of yourself, Panthea. You need to calm down. Let's leave him alive so that he can give his friend a proper burial. So they're like basically saying, we're going to kill this guy and we're going to leave you alive. So, you know, it's like the classic, like, we need one alive to spread the message or whatever.
Oh, yeah. One to remember. That's very considerate, considering how things could have gone in a different direction. I was almost wondering if there was just going to be, like, an option, like, do we tear him limb from limb, or do we castrate him, or do, like, we could take him out for dinner or whatever. just one nice, like, one really thrown into the bunch and stuff like that. Yeah.
We could turn him into a tortoise. Look at him. He looks like a tortoise already. Ha ha. And he's like, oh my god, so funny. I don't know. Yeah.
He's like, I would love to be a tortoise actor. Please, I was thinking the same thing. We're on the same page. Like
you and me, Panthea, we are like two peas in a pod. So then Moreau twists Socrates' head and slices his neck with her sword and catches all the blood in a bottle, like as it's like flowing.
R.I.P. Socrates.
Then she shoves her hand into the wound, reaches down and grabs his heart, and then pulls it out of the neck wound. Then she turns to Panthea, and Panthea then shoves the sponge into the wound, saying, "Now, sponge, you were born in the sea. Take care not to cross a river." Then
what?
Then the two women went over to Aristomenes and peed on him.
Okay.
which I thought was funny.
it's a last little thing thrown up. I don't know. I want to be surprised by the horrific act of cutting off the head and ripping out the heart and putting a sponge inside. I don't know. Maybe I'm desensitized to all the ancient acts at this point in time.
Yeah,
after the Caligula sure. episode, nothing will cross me anymore.
I know that was yeah, it's true. Maybe
but the peeing is too far. That's too far. That's where I draw the line.
So then they just left. And the door floated back to its proper place as they, like, walked out.
That's pretty badass, actually. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So then Aristomenes realizes, he's like, I need to leave, or people will think that I killed Socrates. So he goes to the door, but now it won't open. So Moreau used her old tricks of locking doors again, I guess.
Oh, man. Sealed inside. These people need windows.
True.
I'm telling you.
He calls to the porter. To open his door so that he may leave early. I guess the porter is like a night guard kind of person who like lives in the inn or like works at the inn. The porter like hears his calls and like comes to the door and says, no, it's like too dangerous at night. And then he says, plus, how do I know you didn't kill your companion or trying to make a break for it? That's crazy of you to say that.
Yeah. Hey, Socrates, prove you're still alive. Yeah, I'm still alive. I swear. Yeah. See, you can hear him. God. He's right here.
What am I thinking? There's something that does something exactly like that. What is? Oh my god.
There's like a My Cousin Vin, or no, My Cousin Vin, no.
Weekend at Bernie's, yes, but I'm trying
Weekend
to think.
Weekend at Bernie's. There we go.
Yeah. Okay. So I finally remember what I was thinking about. It's from Toy Story 1, where Woody is in Sid's house, and he's trying to communicate with the toys that are back in Andy's house through the window, and all he has to prove that Buzz is there with him is his arm. So he's, like, poking Buzz's arm out from behind the window and pretending to be like, oh, hey, Woody, I'm so grateful to you. Oh, thanks, Buzz. Anyway, that's what I was thinking about. Okay, back to the show. So Aristomenes then sees no survival option. He ties a noose from his sheets and then tries to hang himself. But the sheets snap and he like falls to the floor. The noise of him falling then brings the porter to the door and he demands to know what that was.
Not a dead body, I swear, I promise.
The porter then unlocks the door and like barges in. And then as he barges in, Socrates sits up and yells about how rude he is to barge into their room while they're sleeping.
Wait, rewinding real quick. Did they cut off Socrates' head? No, they just
cut it. They just cut it, they just pulled out his heart, and then stuffed a sponge into the neck wound.
Okay, so they opened the Ziploc bag. They didn't rip off the top. Okay, cool.
Sure, yeah.
That's my metaphor. I'm sticking to it.
So Aristomenes is stunned. He's like, what? You were dead. And yeah. Socrates is like, come now, Aristomenes, let's be off. This guy is so rude for like barging in. The two then leave, and Socrates notes how bad Aristomenes smells. Because he smells like pee.
Yeah. I'm sure that Socrates also smells fine now. There's no issues of putrefying or anything.
As the two walk, Socrates remarks that he had a weird dream where he was stabbed. And Aristomenes is like, I guess I had the same dream.
If only they had Enkidu around to interpret that dream. Damn.
that's a very good reference. I appreciate that. What Nick is referencing is the previous episode of the It's a Classic podcast, the Epic of Gilgamesh and Enkidu, which I named the Epic of Enkidu and Gilgamesh because I feel like Enkidu gets shafted too much.
Enkidu deserves recognition for his dream ability,
his dream interpreting. I interpret that means that you will be stabbed soon.
Yeah, probably. Also, don't cross rivers. I get a feeling. I don't know.
I don't know. So eventually, the two stop and eat, and they recline in a retreat eating cheese, because, you know, Aristomenes is a cheese salesman, after all.
Yeah, he's probably got some on him.
So Socrates then inhaled the food and became thirsty afterwards, and Aristomenes points out that there's a nearby stream that he could drink from. Socrates, yeah?
No. I mean, sponge, you know, don't go near a river. That's all I'm saying.
You know. Socrates approaches the river and kneels down to drink. And then as his neck crosses the threshold of the river, the sponge shoots out, reopening his neck wound. Socrates then bleeds out and Aristomenes buries him by the river. So you were right.
Okay. I want to know the witch's plan because it's funny. I hope that they were nearby on a hill. They were just, he was like, oh man, I'm thirsty. Like, oh, just go drink in the river. And then he's just walking over and then he's like, oh, wait, do you have a cup at all?
It's just going back and forth or something.
Oh, wait, yeah. I think that there's a better spot over here by the river where I can kneel down into it and then just find.
I'm also imagining that the sponge, right, was like stuck in place, right? Like it was stuck in place, so it wouldn't cross the threshold of the river. So it like shot out like the back of his neck as he crossed the river, because the sponge isn't allowed to cross a river, right?
It got frozen in place.
Yes, oh, that's how I'm imagining it. It doesn't say that specifically, but like that's like what makes sense to me based on the witch curse. You're right though. The plan is kind of weird. If they wanted to kill him, they could have just killed him. Why put the sponge? Why get the sponge involved?
Yeah, I mean, it could be the consideration that they didn't want for Aristophanes to be... It is Aristophanes, correct? Sorry if I'm getting the name wrong.
Aristomenes,
for our good friend,
with an M, yeah.
For our good friend Aristomenes to get convicted for murder. So they were just like, oh, delayed reaction there on the,
right.
on the death.
So you can bury him by the river. It's true.
Yeah.
So now we're going back another layer. So we're back to Lucius. He's listening to this story. And he's like, wowee, what a story. I believe
wowee,
it.
The origin of SpongeBob SquarePants. Right
there. There we go. He's like, I believe it. Nothing is impossible. He then bids his goodbye to the travelers because they turned down a side road. And Lucius continues to Thessaly. So that's like the first little like expansion in the story. But we continue. Now we're going to stick with Lucius for like a little bit.
The first little bubble of story.
Exactly. So he enters the town of Hypatia and asks where to find a man named Milo. So he has a letter for him from his friend Demeas of Corinth, and he is told that Milo lives on the edge of town in a large house, and Milo is rich, but lives in squalor, and he's kind of hated by everyone. So he's like super rich, but his house is like very empty and weird. So Lucius then heads to the house and knocks, and he is let in by a slave girl named Fotis after he mentions that he has a letter for Milo.
Okay. Does he actually have a letter for Milo?
He does, yeah, apparently.
Okay.
This isn't like his cover. Yeah, Lucius is very vague about what he's doing at any given time, but this time he seems to be legit.
He might also be a cheese salesman. We don't
know. we don't know his MO.
Yeah.
He enters to find Milo sitting on a small couch before an empty table with his wife sitting on the floor. he explains, Milo explains, that he has so little furniture so no one will break in and steal anything from him.
I'm surprised that somebody married him.
I don't imagine she had much of a choice.
That's true.
Yeah, unfortunately. So Milo like happily reads the letter. He's like, "Oh, it's good to hear from my friend Demeas." And then he
that's
invites Lucius
he has
to stay.
Friends.
Yeah.
Does he have beds? That's the follow up question.
I think he does have beds. He invites Lucius to stay, and he remarks on his gentlemanly looks and virginal energy, which I feel like is not a nice thing to say to someone, but I think it's funny. You strike me as a virgin. I want you to stay in my home.
Yeah.
What happened.
I have no comments on that. That's just weird. Sure.
It is weird.
That's a weird radar to have.
Milo's a weird dude.
I'll say.
Lucius accepts, and he heads to the market to buy dinner and take a bath. He buys some fish, and then he bumps into an old college friend whose name was Pythias. And Pythias is now a marshal who regulates prices on the market. And he asks Lucius how much he paid for those fish. And when Lucius tells him, he's outraged. Lucius then takes Pythias to the fishmonger, and Pythias forces the man to trample on his fish for overselling.
Does he also have to return the money, or is that just the fish gone?
No. So now Lucius has no dinner and no money for dinner.
No!
So he then that's just a very weird aside. Like, it has no greater bearing on the wider story, but it's a weird picture.
I feel like the author just, like, ran into a point where, like, over the course of writing, just he knows that he got outsold by a fishmonger, and he was like,
he's like, oh, these dirty fishmongers.
I'm gonna add a section in here where I'm just gonna... This is political satire right here. That's what this is.
There is a bit of that in this story as well. Like, kind of like, we'll get into it later, but I think there is a lot of commentary on, like, religion and stuff later. So Lucius then heads to the bathhouse bays and then returns to Milo's, where he goes to sleep. Lucius then awoke the next morning. So now we're in book two. That was all book one. Lucius awoke at the crack of dawn, excited to explore the city. For it was in the heart of Thessaly that was known for its magic. Plus, he heard the story of Moreau yesterday, and he's like, this place is crazy. But he doesn't find anything magical.
I don't know if I'd want to run into magic at this point. Yeah,
based on the explanations of magic so far, it doesn't sound like a fun experience.
Not at all.
But he does bump into a woman named Berenna, who is a close friend of his mother, who helped raise him. Berenna recognizes Lucius and is like, oh my god, it's been so long, look at you, and she like pinches his cheeks and stuff, I assume.
My little child, hello. Yes.
and he's like, oh, you gotta come stay with me while you're in town, and he's like, I'm already staying with Milo, and Berenna's like, Milo's weird, and he's like, I know, but I already said I would stay with him.
Get out of that house, he's going to kill you. Like, this man is clearly a serial killer.
He's gonna kill you and make you into his second chair. He only has one other chair. So Berenna takes him to show him her house anyway. She's like, I'll come see you, it's so nice. And it is a very, very nice house. It's like huge entrance hall with statues of Victory and Diana. The statue of Diana is particularly detailed with a whole grotto scene and like dogs. It's like a really like ornate, like crazy entrance hall.
And he's immediately regretting his decision.
I would imagine so, right?
Just sobbing in the corner, just that taken.
Like, he's like, I'm sleeping on a bale of hay.
What have I done?
So Berenna then leans in close and whispers an intense warning to him. She says to steer clear of Milo's wife, Pamphile. She's a witch with powerful magic that she uses to seduce young men and then change their form when she is done with them. So very similar to
the comment on virgin energy is starting to make a little bit more sense. I'm not sure why Milo is into it, but that might be
true. Now, despite what you would think, Lucius is actually pumped to hear this news, and he rushes back to Milo's in hope of getting magic lessons from his wife.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, actually, I have a question regarding
this.
So, with their concept of magic, is it as attributed as being something from the gods and kind of deities at this point in time, or is there kind of just like an inert idea of magic that exists separate from deities?
I think that this is like a very kind of foreign magic, the way it's explained, at least. Like, it's not ever attributed to a particular god or goddess. Very much kind of how I mentioned Medea earlier. Medea's magic, like, she is descended from the gods, but she is spoke of in this kind of weird, kind of like foreign, like very Eastern, like mindset, where it's like, oh, she's like different and weird, and that's why she has these kind of magic powers. And I think that these kind of witches are spoke of in a very similar way. They're not like, it's not ever stated that they're using the power of like Juno or something to like do these kind of magics. It's very like, yeah, it's very different and very much relying on like physical materials, right? They need to do like full on rituals and things like that. So it's different and it is very interesting the way that magic is kind of portrayed. We'll get into it more later.
They're treated as kind of inherently out of the ordinary. Interesting. Yeah, that is very interesting. It's probably medicine or something like
there
that.
There is, they also talk.
Not the frogs, but.
Not the transformation. There is also like talk of like power from the gods, but since the magic isn't spoken of in that same way, I would say that it's like distinctly different.
A different brand. Kirkland versus non-Kirkland.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So then Lucius gets back, but only Fotis, the servant, is home. Lucius then begins like musing like about philosophy, and he's talking about what is beauty, what makes women beautiful, and then he talks about hair for a really long time, saying that no one would love Venus if she were bald. It's like, it's very weird. He talked about hair for a really long time, and this is all.
I think I've seen a Twitter thread semi recently from some fool of a similar.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like he's just letting it loose into the air.
Yeah. So, but I think this was all inner monologue because, like, Fotis is there and, like, doesn't react. But maybe it's not. And she just is like, I don't know what to say to this.
Yeah, she's just ignoring him. She's
like, this guy's weird. He also, like, admires Fotis's hair, saying that her casual nature is the most alluring or something. And then he starts flirting with her and she reciprocates. And she promises to come to his room at dusk. So that's cool, I guess.
That virgin energy is going to be tired.
I know. Like the next morning, Milo's like, you don't have the same energy. I kind of want you to leave my house.
Yeah, you've kind of like, it's like a glow, but like,
but I don't like it. It's
things.
Gross.
Yeah.
Someone might steal you from me. Yeah. So then we cut to dinner that night. And Lucius is making sure to avoid Pamphile's eyes and always directing his attention to Fotis. I guess because he's worried that she's going to use her witch magic to seduce him. Pamphile regards there will be a cloudburst tomorrow, and the nearby oil lamp had predicted that. Yeah, of course. Lucius then, he's like, oh, speaking of predicting things, I have a friend whose name is Diophanes, and he's a prophet. And then Milo is like, I also know Diophanes. And then, like, Milo starts talking and talking and talking. So, like, if we thought Lucius was, like, kind of a chatterbox, like, Milo is, like, beyond it. And so Lucius is like, oh, my God, I just want to leave.
Just zoning into the mashed potato on his plate.
He's like, <"Ugh." laughs> Lucius is antsy because he wants to meet with Fotis, so he excuses himself. The two then meet in his room, drink wine, and make passionate love all night. And this continues for several nights. There's a lot of detail on the lovemaking, but I was like, hey, it's a lot. So I'm not going to go into it.
You are cheating me, Zion.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
Why do you think I came here?
So
for interesting historical anecdote? No.
No. For graphic descriptions of sex. So then, like, several days later, right, because this has continued for several nights, their relationship, Berenna, the friend of his mother's, invites Lucius over for dinner. And he goes both to his and Fotis's reluctance. He's like, I kind of want to just, like, sleep with Fotis again, but I guess I'll go to dinner at my, like, mom's friend's house. Before he leaves, Fotis warns him about some hooligans who have been killing people lately. He assures her that he will return safely, and he carries his sword with him at all times just to be safe. Dinner at Brenna's is nice. The food is wonderful. The conversation, because of course it does, turns more to the macabre. With Lucius remarking that the dead don't seem well off because witches come to steal parts of them for their spells. So this is what I was talking about, where you need, like, components to do spells, and a lot of it is based around dead bodies.
Interesting.
So then...
I mean, that enhances my little medical theory there. They're just looking at dead bodies, dude.
They're just like... So someone then remarks that the living aren't safe either, and everyone laughs and looks at another guest who begins to rise to leave. And Berenna then insists that this guest, Telephron, stay and share his story. He's like, I really don't want to. And they're like, tell it. And he's like,
I thought he was just going to die on the spot. I thought that was what they're just, and not everyone is safe, and everybody just looks, and somebody and just lumps over.
He just, like, clutches his chest and dies.
Well, I'll be going now.
So then Telephron starts to tell his story, and this is, like, you know, we're getting into another. So this is a bit of a longer, interjection story, but it's a good one. So he starts a story and says that he had been traveling as a young man and ran low on funds in Larissa, so he searched for a way to make some money. He encountered an old man standing near a dead body and yelling like a carnival barker about negotiating the price for someone to watch it. So, like, there's a dead body just on the street. There's a dude just yelling, like, give me, you know, I can't do the carnival, like, the auctioneer voice, kind of.
Come see the maggots! Come see...
For a nickel, you can see the wonder of death! Yeah, something like that.
This one's a smelly one, let me tell ya.
So then, Telephron then stops a passerby, and he's like, what's the deal with this guy and the dead body? And they're like, super common here, witches would come and take parts of corpses... So people would pay to have them guarded so that they don't get, like, stolen. You have to keep your eyes on the corpse at all times, for witches can shapeshift, so they would swoop in during the smallest lapse of focus. So you had to be, like, constantly vigilant. And if anything was taken from the dead body, the watcher would have to make up for it. So, like, they would pay you unless you lost something from the dead body, and then you wouldn't get paid, and you'd also have to pay them for whatever was stolen.
You'd have to pay an arm and a leg for the experience.
Yeah, I guess you would. Depending.
Yep.
So Telephron had heard enough, and he's like, oh man, free money. So he approaches the crier. The two then negotiate a price, and the crier then tells Telephron to go to the house of the dead man. There he meets the widow, and she demands that he promise to remain vigilant. He's like, I swear. And then they bring in the body and catalog all that it has. So they bring in the body to this room, and then they go through like a list, and they're like, he's got his eyes, yep, he's got his ears, yep, he's got his nose, yep.
Beautifully manicured nails, just incredible work, actually.
Isn't wow.
Do you have a nail salon nearby?
Why is there no dirt under these nails? He was a farmer.
This is a pretty good haircut. What the heck?
I might try to steal that hair, am I right?
Yeah.
So then they all leave, and Telephron is alone with the body. He sat silently with the body for hours. Nothing happened. And then a weasel jumps in through the window.
A weasel.
But Telephron then yells at it, and it leaves. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. But if it was
like, I'm also here to watch the body. Like, come on, man.
He's like, I slept with a witch, and she turned me into a weasel. No, I mean.
Please help!
So as the weasel leaves, a shadow leaps into the room, covering Telephron and pulling him into the deepest sleep that he has ever known. Oh. So, spooky, the weasel and the shadow were in partnership.
We're in cahoots.
He wakes the next morning in a panic and rushes over to the body and sees that all the facial features of the body are still there. So he's like, oh, it's fine. No, nobody stole anything.
The essentials.
Minutes later.
Better
check under what?
Just check under the blanket or whatever. Okay. Yeah, man.
Like, just the head is the blanket, left. Like, just, yeah, exactly. Just the head. And then he's like,
the butt's gone.
Minutes later, the widow and the witnesses return and they pay him. He's like, oh, nice job. Everything's still there. He says to the widow, that's like, you could count on me among your servants, and I'm able to offer my services whenever. The household is then very offended by this, because the implication is that, like, I'll guard your next close family member who dies.
I was about to say, when you die, I'll be there, man.
Very, very, very much like, God, you're right, it's another Pokemon reference. Very much a Pokemon Center energy, where they're like, we hope to see you again after healing your Pokemon. So then, he's like, he pockets his money, and he's like, all right, cool. So he leaves. Later that day, Telephron sees the funeral procession of the man that he watched. He's like, oh, look, that's cool. And as it passes through the center of town, an old man halts the procession, and a hush falls over the crowd. He explains that I am this dead man's uncle, and that my nephew's death was due to being poisoned by his own wife. And he, like, points dramatically at the wife, and the wife's like, ah!
There's just some guy in an organ just in the corner, just dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. It's very much this kind of like over the top, like, energy. The crowd then murmurs with this rumor. They're like, oh my God. The uncle then continues saying that, I know this is a bold claim, but I have with me a man named Zatchlas, and he's from Egypt, and he is a priest who has agreed to briefly resurrect the dead to hear his story.
Yeah, I mean, that would do it.
Yeah, so Egypt, this will come up again, like, much later in the story. But Egypt is also talked about as, like, this very kind of, like, powerful, magical society. Like, a lot of, like, power comes from Egypt. Because the gods there, I think, are, like, different and interesting to, like, the Roman kind of psyche, right? They're like, we don't understand these Egyptian gods. They're weird.
It makes sense in the imperial mind. Actually, sorry, real quick. You might have mentioned at the beginning. When was this written in the Roman history? Do we know?
This was written this around the year, around 150 AD.
Okay, so yeah. So kind of full swing empire.
No longer republic. Yeah. So he's saying, I have with me Zatchlas of Egypt, a priest who has agreed to briefly resurrect the dead to hear his story. Zatchlas then places herbs over the dead man's mouth and heart and gestures towards the sun. The body then begins to breathe and eventually sits up with a snap.
I don't like that. That's a good description, though. Just whoosh.
The body. So then the man, the dead man, he's like, starts moaning. He's like, why did you wake me up? I want to go back to sleep.
I haven't slept this well in 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. So upon the demands of the uncle, the body then confirms that, yes, I died because my wife poisoned me. So then the crowd is now yelling. It's like, oh, my God, the wife should be put to death. The body then continues. He's not done. He's like, I've got more to tell. And everyone's like, oh, okay. We'll let the dead person speak.
I thought you wanted to go back to sleep. Come on, man.
He's like, I'm up now.
Yeah. I have things to say.
he says that this will prove that he speaks the truth, because like he's like, how do you know you can trust me? He points at Telephron, who's like in the crowd, just like chilling, I guess. And says that this is the man who guarded his body. He was vigilant up until the witches cursed him into sleep. And everyone's like, oh. The witches then began to call my name over and over, letting the magic seep into their words. And the name that they call, so they called the dead man's name, as Telephron was asleep. So the name that they called out, though, was Telephron. It just so happened that they both had the same name. Oh. So eventually, as the witches kept calling out the name Telephron, the dead man began to move and like be like pulled towards the doorway, right? Because the witches were going to like harvest him. But before he could, the other Telephron got up and went to the doorway and beat him to it. In his deathless sleep, he walked to the witches and they cut off his nose and ears. Then they replaced them with wax so that he wouldn't notice.
Telephron's just leaning up against a wall. The sun is just beating down.
Yeah, and then, like, his ears and nose start melting. Telephron realizes that this was true and then runs off with the crowd laughing at his misfortune. And that's the end of his story. So then we cut back to the dinner and all the dinner guests are also laughing at him.
God.
So yeah, I was like, oh my God, this is just like the Batman v Superman thing. It's like, your mother's name is Martha. It's like, oh yeah, our names happen to be the same. So he got his nose cut off instead of me.
Save Telephron. Why did you say that? Why did you say that name?
So yeah, all the guests are laughing at him. So I really like that story. And also the weird concept of having to watch a body for witches is also pretty cool. So then, yeah, all the guests are laughing at him, right? They're laughing it up. And
it must have been a pretty good wax reproduction, though, of a nose and ears, because I would think that I would notice if my
nose and ears were gone.
I would think. Maybe not, but
I don't know. Think I would. I feel like you would, yeah.
I think I would.
So then Berenna then informs Lucius that tomorrow is the festival for the god of laughter, and it would be great if he could demonstrate his wit tomorrow. This is like just a casual conversation after, and Lucius is like, okay, yeah, I can do that. He then heads back to Milo's, and he sees three young men slamming themselves into the door. And then he realizes that these are the ruffians that Fotis warned him about.
Dun, dun, dun.
He then draws his sword and then kills all three of them.
That was quick. I thought that was going to be a longer fight.
No, I mean, they go into a bit more detail, but they basically just go into detail about how he's slicing them apart. He then enters the house and collapses in his bed, exhausted. And that is the end of book two. Now we're on to book three.
He's solving a lot of problems. He got rid of the ruffians, which is good.
Yeah,
I would also be tired after. My goodness.
Then the next morning he wakes up and he squats on his bed and begins to cry. He realizes that what he has done is illegal. Kill three people.
The heat of the moment. You forget about those pesky laws called laws. Yeah. Damn.
Exactly. He then goes downstairs because there's a pounding at the door. He opens the door and a flood of people enter the house and arrest him for killing people.
Wow.
The crowd then like puts him in chains and like drags him along with them, and they take him to like court. And the captain of the night guard begins to speak his testimony. He recounts what he saw. He says, Lucius killed three dudes, and then ran into the house. Just like, you know,
I like to think he's that nonchalant about it too.
Oh yeah.
Man up here, there was three dudes. I saw him, and they died.
Like very much like how I also described them like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, just very roundabout.
Yeah. Then Lucius then offers his side. He said he was coming home, and I saw these three men trying to break into the house. And then he even says, and they didn't mention this the night before, but he even says, I heard them say that they were trying to break in and kill everybody. I was just doing my job to protect the community. And then as soon as he finishes the story, he starts crying again. Because he's very sad. Then everyone around him begins to laugh. And then, because I guess they just, you know, they think they're like, ah, oh, look, a grown man crying.
Yeah, I was about to say, these people's sense of humor is just awful.
Yeah.
Laughing at the man who had his
end. Who has no nose or ears.
Just, I mean, there's not much to laugh at probably back then, but gosh, heartless.
A widow then emerges from the crowd clutching a baby. She pleads that let justice be served. This baby is now left fatherless because of this man.
I feel like this has turned into like funny. The Dr. Phil equivalent of the trial, just like, but he had a son, like just coming out of the crowd. They've been here the whole time in the crowd. Do you want to talk to the child of the
killed? The magistrate then agrees that Lucius must be put to death, but first he will be tortured to determine who assisted him in his crime, because I guess they think that it was like he couldn't possibly have killed these three men by himself.
And he's just shrugging like, I'm just built different.
What can I say?
My sword is real sharp. Like, let me tell you, like butter.
They were nothing to me. I would do it again.
Yeah. That's kind of what he's crying, but he just went to bed the night before. I think this is an act, man.
Yeah. Then they bring in fire and whips and et cetera. And the widow says, let the bodies be shown so that the world can see the young men who were robbed of their lives.
This woman should be a lawyer.
Yeah, she's
she's good.
The magistrate then forced Lucius to remove the cloths covering the bodies. Eventually, he's like, he's crying. He's like, please don't make me do it. and then he grabs the sheet and he rips it off. And then he reveals three large wineskins cut in the same way as the bodies that Lucius remembers from last night. At that moment, the crowd erupts in uproarious laughter.
Was this a prank? Was this a...
Lucius is petrified and confused. Milo then emerges from the crowd and claps him on the back, jolting him out of his stupor. The magistrates reveal that this has all been part of the yearly festival of laughter, and thanks Lucius for being a part of it, for he had agreed to it the night before. So yes, it was...
Were the men... Did he really kill people?
No.
Or were they just... Yeah,
they were just wineskins.
They were just wineskins against... Oh, it must have been really dark out. Okay.
I guess so. And he was... I think he was also drunk, I guess.
That makes sense. Yep, good.
I know, what a prank. It's insane.
I can only imagine what the year before print, like they were just like, we gotta do better this year. Okay, how do we fake a murder? Like, we've already faked some arson. We've burned down three people's houses.
Like, yeah, they just burned down people's houses and were like, haha, you volunteered for the laughter festival, sorry.
Haha, you volunteered. We built you replacements. They're smaller, but...
but it's fine. So then he arrives back at Milo's house, embarrassed and exhausted, and he collapses into bed. Fotis then enters and confesses that she was a part of the whole thing and wants to apologize.
As she should. My goodness.
Lucius is like, I forgive you, and then they kiss. So then Fotis is like, I should probably explain, like, how the thing worked. Then Lucius is like, yeah, yes, please. So...
Yeah, please.
Fotis then explains the lady of the house, right, Pamphile, has crazy powers. The stars do her bidding, the dead obey her, and the elements are her slaves.
I need more explanation, actually. Okay. This has only raised more questions.
Pamphile had been fancying a Boeotian recently, and she told Fotis to get some of his hair. But Fotis got caught by the barber stealing hair from the Boeotian. On her way home, she saw a man shaving some goatskin wineskins and took some of their hair, hoping that Pamphile wouldn't notice. So then last night, Pamphile went up to the roof of the house with the goat hair, but also jars of blood, ears, noses, and fingers, and entrails of animals and humans. Because, like, she needed to do her spell.
She was doing her stuff.
Yeah, she then spoke an incantation over the entrails mixed with milk, honey, and wine, and then next she added the goat hair from the wineskins. The spell then caused the goat skins, who were far away, to gain human life, and they hopped all the way to Milo's house trying to, like, get to Pamphile. Who they were now, like, in love with. Like, she was trying to, like, put, like, a charm on this dude, but because she got wineskin hair, the wineskins, like, were brought to life and, like, were trying to break into the house.
Were animated. This just shows that the improvisational skills of the town.
No, I know, yeah, the prank then wasn't planned.
They were just like, let's just roll with it. Like, this is it.
basically, what happened is they saw a bunch of torn up wineskins on the front door and were like, let's pretend this guy killed people. So it was these wineskins that Lucius saw trying to break into the house.
Those must be big wineskins as well. Like, I'm trying to think about this. I always imagine them to kind of be like the size of an average boxed wine.
Mm-hmm.
But for a human, maybe a child.
Yeah, maybe a child. He kills. He's like, I'll kill children, adults. I don't care.
They're ruffians. It makes no difference to me.
Lucius then. So Lucius and Fotis then share a laugh, remarking that this is truly on par with acts of Heracles or Ajax. So they're just like, oh, I'm such a hero, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about that one. They're pumping themselves up a little bit. Yeah.
Very weird. Lucius then asks if he can see Pamphile do her magic. Like, he's like, I think magic is crazy, and I'd like to see some. and Fotis is like, yeah, okay, I'll keep you posted on that. A few days later, Fotis comes to Lucius saying that Pamphile will transform into a bird tonight to go to fly to her love, the Boeotian. So after nightfall, the two crept into Pamphile's room and looked through a crack in the door. So, like, then they see Pamphile strip naked, rub ointment all over herself, and then chant and, like, flap her arms. Slowly, she grew feathers.
And nothing happened.
They were watching a weird sex ritual.
Yep. They left the door at this point.
They were like, this is awkward, we should leave.
Yeah.
As she flapped her arms, she grew more and more feathers and slowly shifted into an owl. Then she flew away. Lucius then is like, oh my god, Fotis, go in there and get me that ointment so that I can become a bird.
Yeah. This is going to go poorly. This is bad. Owl is a good choice of bird, though. I feel like somebody's going to end up permanently an owl, and there are worse birds to be.
True. After some convincing, she's like, I don't know. He's like, please. She goes in and runs and grabs the box of ointment. Fotis then assures Lucius that the reversal process is pretty easy. And Lucius is like,
sure,
okay, cool.
Sure.
Lucius spreads the ointment on and starts to flap his arms, but they don't become wings. His legs grow hair, and his hands harden into hooves. His face elongates, and he is forced down on all fours. He has become a donkey.
Oh, I thought he was going to become a horse, and that was going to be... Oh, wait, is this the golden ass?
Yes.
Is this the titular golden
ass? This is indeed.
Oh, although, incredible.
I don't think he's golden, but he's just a donkey.
Well, yeah. It's the heart. It's golden inside.
This is also the titular metamorphosis, if we're going by the other title.
We've reached it. Okay.
We're fairly early in the story, but it's already happened. So he does note that he's like, this is horrible. There's nothing good about the situation, except for one thing. My penis is a lot bigger as a donkey, which I also thought was pretty funny.
Yeah. He's checking all the important... It's like when the Doctor transforms in Doctor Who, just checking all the important features.
He's just like...
chin and everything like that, except this time checking the penis as well.
Still got hands. Yeah.
Yep, still got him.
Fotis is like, oh no, I mixed up the boxes of ointment somehow. I used the donkey ointment.
Oh my gosh, wait, this is just a mixture of a little bit of Emperor's New Groove.
Yep.
And I'm going to choose to imagine that it's Eddie Murphy's voice on the donkey as well.
Sure, so it's also Shrek.
So a little bit of Shrek. That's my artistic liberty, but
She says, okay, it's no worries, all you have to do is eat roses and you'll turn back into a human. But we don't have any roses, so I'll go get some. In the meantime, you should go to the stable, because otherwise Milo's going to be like, why is there a donkey in the house? So Lucius now then goes to the stable and stands next to the other donkey. And he's like, man, how did I get here? What led me to this situation?
I swear to God, if the other donkey talks back to him.
Then Lucius
tell you what happened to me.
He's like, oh, man, well, you also got turned into a donkey, huh? Rough. Yeah. Used to be a cheese salesman. Whoa!
No. Whoa!
So then Lucius hears some commotion, and he sees there's a huge band of robbers that have just broken into the house. They emerge with sacks of loot, which I don't know what they were stealing, because Milo doesn't have anything.
I was about to say, they should have just like a little sack with a sad chair in it.
They have chair, and they're running off with it. Yeah. And then they're like, oh man, what do we do with all this loot? And then they look and they see two donkeys. They're like, oh, perfect. And they load the donkeys up with the loot. And then they steal Lucius and the other donkey, use them as pack animals, and make off into the night.
Oh, no.
Miles and miles away, as he's being led, Lucius is freaking out. As they stop for the night, he looks and he sees some roses. And he's like, oh my god, I could eat them, turn back. Then he realizes, if I do that, the robbers will kill me. So
I'm
must
just gonna be a naked human in the middle of camp. This
exactly.
Is not gonna...
So I will stay as a donkey and bide my time and wait for my opportunity to escape. And that is where we will call the first section of the Metamorphosis, a.k.a. the Golden Ass.
Oh, no, it's such a cliffhanger. I can't believe. Oh, my goodness. No, okay, here's what I think is going to happen.
Oh, okay, some predictions.
Go on a long-ranging journey and realize it's better to be a donkey than anything else. And that'll be the ending. You'll be like, humans are lame.
I thought you were just going to predict that it would play out exactly like the Emperor's New Groove.
It could also be no. I think that he's going to become attached to his form. Mm-hmm. Just be like, this is the real me. I found it.
This is the true, like Brother Bear, like Brother Bear,
like Brother Bear, exactly like Brother Bear. It's been a while since I is that how it is?
Just, yeah, he decides to stay as a bear, yeah. So he can be with Coda, the little Brother Bear, the titular Brother Bear, yeah. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me for this first episode. What did you think of the first part of the Golden Ass?
I think that it is clearly a work of comedic genius so far.
True.
I said I was going to be very harsh on this story, but no, I have no criticism. I think that other than Milo's treatment of his wife and his hesitancy to embrace the beauty of interior design, I think it's wonderful.
So you think Milo's the true villain of this story so far?
It would not surprise me if by the end Milo he turns out to be the mastermind behind all of it. He hired the bandits actually himself to
rob his own house.
To affirm his own fears. Yeah, he's like, this is not an irrational fear. There are people that are going to rob me and I'll pay them to do it.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm glad you liked it. So I'm just trying to think how to wrap up. Is there any sort of lesson we could take away from this first part of this story?
Don't eat sponges.
Oh good, that's a good one.
Don't cross a river.
Don't ever cross a river with the sponge in your throat.
Yeah. Don't cross a witch, and if you do, don't cross a river either.
Oh, that's good. I like that. That's snappy. Put that on a t-shirt. Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Mwah.